another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host, minister, and friend, Chino Ross, pastor and the voice of the Understanding Scripture and Truth by Chino D. Ross YouTube channel. Chino, this is one of the episodes that I'm going to say I've been waiting for this buildup, because as you and I have talked, I love psychology and the effects of the mind, and just looking at how all of this plays out whenever you're with some kind of a group like this. It's fascinating to me and sad at the same time. I'm fascinated because it's really odd to see how it all works, and it's sad because of how it all works. But if you were to take, instead of a religion, think that this is a used car lot, and you go to a used car salesman and he sells you this car, it's the greatest thing ever, it's going to get you from point A to point B, and you get home and you realize that the transmission doesn't really work like he said it did, and you can't quite make it from point A to point B. And then if that used car salesman died, how you would think about this guy? This guy sold me a piece of junk, right? I was sold a false bill of goods. And yet whenever a cult leader dies, especially in these divine healing cults, it's really the same thing. They have sold you a false bill of goods. But when they die, there's this effort to try to lift them up as though the false bill of goods was the perfect thing for you. And it's just fascinating to me to think through that, because how the mind critically shuts off everything whenever you're talking about religion. But if you start talking about anything that affects your pocketbook, such as buying a car, buddy, you're gonna pay attention to every single detail.
You don't even know where I'm going, John, with what I want to talk about today, but you kind of know where I'm going with what I want to talk about today. With that introduction, you've been in and out of a similar group in your past life, so you know how these things work. So when those predictions that Hobart gave about other people, about himself, the prophecies that he gave, the prophecies other people gave about him and his alleged future ministry, when the claims that he made about his own healing and health and future ministry, when those things don't come to pass and can't come to pass because the person is now dead, then what do we do? You know, as long as he's still alive, then he can continue to say, well, we have 16 visions that have confirmed the healing of my polio short leg, and we're just waiting for number 17 and 18 and 19. And you can get in the group and have a confirmatory vision and be a part of cult lore and say, yes, God showed me in a vision, Brother Freeman, when you were healed, God is somehow going to help the whole body here at Faith Assembly, and we're all going to receive our healings. That works as long as you continue to live. Whenever you die, now the propaganda machine has fired up. And what I saw happen was that the dishonesty in the leadership soon became reflected in the dishonesty of the membership. And when I say dishonesty, I don't mean that the leadership necessarily came out and just said, you know, point blank from the pulpit. Our pastor was, yesterday, our pastor went to be with the Lord. God took him up in a chariot, just like he did Elijah. You know, I'm not saying anybody actually came and told a bold-faced lie, but what I have accused them of is dishonesty in what they didn't say. It was dishonesty in silence. It was dishonesty in the people, including Mrs. Freeman, including the daughters, including the top aides and ministers, the people who knew how Dr. Freeman died, that he died terribly, terribly sick. He couldn't even talk at the end of his life, according to Jack Farrell, an eyewitness there. He was having to take water, little tiny sips through a straw. And we've looked all about in the past the medical reports. And everything that medically, factually, physically, bodily was wrong with Dr. Freeman. He died weighing, they said, somewhere between 125 and 128 pounds, with just, you know, he was literally a walking dead man, or a lying in his bed dead man, with everything that he had wrong. So I'm not saying that people came and said that he died healthy, although I've seen reports of a few people who said that. We know that's not true. I don't think the people at Faith Assembly the next morning, the next week, the next month, the next year had any idea how bad off he was. It would be over a process of time where either A, some of the details would leak out from people who were actually eyewitnesses, or B, someone would finally decide to pick up a newspaper. And if they picked up a newspaper, and I can't imagine what the feeling was the first time one of those families did that and read what it had to say, oh my word, what a shock that would have been, because they had been told newspapers are evil, the media are evil people, and everything they say is a lie. But they're reporting about a man's death that factually happened. And when you're reading the accounts, even in the newspaper, even not reading a medical report, but even in the local, either Fort Wayne or Warsaw newspaper, they could get the facts of how Dr. Freeman died. And so what happens, as I said, the propaganda machine is fired up and it runs in full motion. And it reminds me, John, of any time a cult leader like Freeman dies, or even if they don't die, anytime a religious figure who is in a ministry of authoritarianism makes a prediction and it doesn't come to pass, then rather than deal with the facts, what you have is something very, very similar to whenever the communists took over Russia. You know, in our lifetime, all we think of when we think of the Soviet Union is communism, but Russia wasn't always communist. Russia was a decent country until the early 1900s, in the days of Lenin and the Bolshevik Revolution. When the Bolshevik Revolution happened in Russia in 1917, it went on to become the USSR. And what the Bolsheviks did, and what Lenin and the communists did, is they completely rewrote the history books. And you rewrite the books so that they line up with your current philosophy. And so this is exactly what was happening at Faith Assembly. I don't remember the first time I got this response, but I do remember getting it over and over and absolutely being shocked. And because I got this response multiple times, it told me that it had started up somewhere high in Faith Assembly leadership, either the family and or the ministers, and then it had been picked up by everyone. But when I would try to bring up two Faith Assembly ministers or people, now when I say bring up, I mean in 1985, right after Hobart died, the fact that he had died and the fact that that shouldn't have happened according to their theology, and it should cause a great concern in their theology. You'll never guess what I was told. And I was so shocked, I didn't even have a response. I had to sit there and think about that for a moment. Did I hear what I just heard? When I said, wait a minute, there's got to be something terribly wrong with this church. Hobart taught divine healing, no doctors, no pills. You claim your healing, you pray once, you receive it then, you confess it, you act on it, you endure it, and God will manifest it. And none of that happened as far as manifestation goes for Hobart. What are you going to do with that? Here was the response. They said, we have a verse. And doesn't every religious group have a verse? Rather than live in reality and deal with, let's look at maybe what happened, the complexity of it all, and maybe our theology isn't sound, they said, we have a verse, and that was Hebrews 11:13. In the great chapter on faith, there's one little phrase in there that says, these all having died in faith, not receiving the promises. And I just was floored that they would try to use a passage like that. They had to find a verse. They went to the faith chapter, you know, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. They went to the faith chapter and found a verse that said, oh, Hobart died in faith. He totally died in faith. He was totally believing. He was totally right with God. He died in faith because look, there were people in the Bible who died in faith who didn't receive the promise that they had been claiming or they had been waiting on. And, you know, look, all you have to do is just read the preceding and following verses. And that has nothing to do with divine healing. It has to do with promises that those people couldn't have received, promises of the Messiah yet to come. Yes, they died in faith, anticipation of looking forward to something that they themselves didn't physically get to see, but it had nothing to do with divine healing. It had nothing to do with claiming a promise and waiting for it to be manifested. And I have to say, when I heard that argument or that response or that defense, you know, I was pretty mad about that. And it really showed me that even though Hobart, the brains behind the false doctrine, even though he's dead, these people are in a sore and sick place in their mind. Rather than deal with the facts, you know, I said on an earlier podcast, John, as soon as I found out Hobart died, I found out on a Friday. Hobart died on a Saturday. It was 6 days later when I received a newspaper in my mailbox in New England, and I went out there and saw Faith Assembly mourns the death of its leader, a paper that had come out in Indiana on Monday, mailed to me. I don't get it until Friday. As soon as I saw that headline in that paper, I raced in and we called June Freeman, his widow now on the phone, to try to use the trauma of the events that had just happened as hopefully a wake-up moment. Can't you now see there must be something terribly wrong? And of course, she did not receive a thing we had to say. She was very upset, very irate that I would call her and bring that up. But I continue to try to bring it up to other people. There has to be something wrong. I didn't even know at that time what I know now, either about what was happening at Faith Assembly or my own understanding of Scripture. You know, I was 25, 26 years old, 27. I don't remember. I'm in my mid-20s. But I had already begun to progress away from what he said because of the inconsistencies and because of other things. But to hear these people say he died in faith, when he said, and I would tell them, but he said, no one ever dies believing, you only die doubting. He said that over and over. And he also said, don't let anyone tell you any other thing. And here I've got his own congregation going against what he taught. You never die believing, you only die doubting. And then he would also go on to say, and if you do die believing, God will have to raise you from the dead to honor his word. Hence the thought for the next few days and weeks and months that Hobart Freeman might be raised from the dead. According to many different sources, it was even reported that June, his wife, left his Sunday suit at the end of the bed, ready for him post his death, for him to, I don't know, walk in after being resurrected from the dead, put his suit on, be totally healed of polio and the truck accident on the other leg and go to church to preach. Now, look, that may sound like a, I don't know, a tender, warm story of a grieving widow, but I don't see it that way. I see it as someone who is in shock over the fact that your husband has said for years, I'm healed and I won't die, when in fact he does die. I see that as evidence of someone who was simply not living in reality. And I doubt that if the story is true that many sources have reported that she did put the suit at the end of the bed, I doubt she continued that forever.
Like I said, it's really fascinating to me to think through the psychology behind this, because you have a person who clearly told you something that wasn't true, and everybody wants to try to further uplift the untruth. Whenever I first started to think through that, I was watching all these documentaries about cult leaders. Whenever you leave a cult, that's one of the things you do. And the funny part is, in the documentaries, they don't really portray it like it actually is. Whenever there's a big climactic event and the cult leader dies, if the people die with him, that's a massive event and everybody's gone. But for those who died, who left a cult remaining, that's where it gets interesting, because the news doesn't really, in the documentaries, doesn't really portray it like it is. They will tell you this person died and then the cult imploded. They'll say it kind of like this. What they don't tell you is there's going to be a subset of the people that will actually burrow in deeper. They'll get more dedicated to the cult leader than when he was even alive. And it's fascinating because in some ways it mimics the martyr complex. There are people who, if you have an agenda and you do something, the people are just, you know, they might be on your side. But the moment you are a martyr, it resonates with their heart. They dive in deeper. They want to get there. Well, that's what happens with a cult leader. They become a martyr, and they're martyred for their cause. Hobart Freeman, exactly this. He was martyred for his faith healing. He died. Yes, what he said wasn't true, but the people will dive in deeper. They'll become more hardcore believers than they were before. Where it gets really fascinating is you think through the complexities of this, because after that happens, everybody's trying to solve the puzzle. Okay, he was a martyr. He told us this thing didn't happen. How do I reconcile this? And if it's a Christian cult, you go back to the Bible, so you find all these passages where somebody died or somebody did something. Well, who are you going to find when you look this up? You're going to find Jesus Christ every single time. So what happens is the martyrdom complex, the people will relate passages that are supposed to be pointing to Jesus to the cult leader. And I can't say that it's 100% across the board, but almost everyone that I've looked at who had a cult and then died, their followers, you can even read it on the comments feed of our podcast. People just send you passages that were really meant for Jesus Christ to uplift the dead cult leader.
And you know, if I didn't hear that response, John, that he died in faith, again, that just shocked me, and I would challenge them not only with their lifting that verse in Hebrews 11 out of context, but with Hobart's own statements that you don't die in faith, you only die in doubt. If I didn't hear that as a response, the other response, and this was the more dominant one, and this is the one that has continued down to this day. And it goes something like this, that God took Hobart for our sake. He removed Hobart Freeman because the people in that ministry and church had their eyes upon him. And so this was, by removing Hobart, this is to aid in our growth in the Christian life. It's to help us mature. It's to help us look to Jesus and not look to Hobart. That is pretty much what everyone said later and what people have said down to this day. That I, you know, Brother Freeman was a great man of God, but the Lord knew that we needed to grow ourselves and we couldn't just be depending on him. And so God had to remove him so that we could grow in maturity ourselves. So that little saying, though, to me, is cast in the form to make it look like that the people are the cause of Hobart's death. That had the people not been disobeying God, had the people not been looking to Hobart instead of to Jesus, had the people been living correctly in their life, you know, then I think logic would say, I guess Hobart would still be alive or would not have died, at least at that time. So they're still trying to protect the image and the reputation of Freeman by saying, well, the only reason that he died was God was trying to help us mature. Again, I have to say, and I think I've said this before, to use that as the argument why Hobart died. I mean, another argument is Hobart was just terribly wrong in his life, his doctrine, his theology, his practice, how he related to people, how he related to the church, how he related to everything and everyone. He was completely wrong. Rather than that, it's no, we were wrong and God had to take him. It's a sign to me, John, of having been in a long-term abusive relationship, because anytime you're in an abusive relationship and something goes wrong with the one doing the abuse, then the people being abused, the wife, the children, the people, whomever, the people being abused always continue the abuse and blame what happened to the abuser on themselves. And they say, well, he didn't do anything wrong. In other words, what they're saying is that the fault didn't lie in Hobart for his early death. The fault lied completely in us. But, you know, look, that, as I say, that is a sign of someone who has been in an abusive relationship. When you're in a healthy relationship and something happens to someone else, you just say it happened to someone else. It didn't have anything to do with me. And this is what the Bible teaches. The Bible teaches that the soul that sinneth, it shall die. God holds people personally responsible for their own life and actions and death. In other words, God isn't going to come along and kill some innocent person, i.e. Hobart Freeman. He's not going to come along and kill some innocent person for the benefit of a larger group of people. That's just not how things work. And so after Dr. Freeman died, you're hearing all of these different fabricated stories and excuses. And I just, at that time, I always felt that the people at Faith Assembly were just dying the death of a thousand cuts. They were dying the death of a thousand cuts. They had so many lies and so many half-truths and so much misinformation that followed the death of Hobart Freeman. I wasn't there at the church. So, you know, I only know what I know from talking to people or reading people's accounts. I had already begun prior to Hobart Freeman's death to question things. So all this did was Hobart's death just, you know, expedited my exit from Freemanism. And it still in my life continued for several years after that. You just, as I've said, as we have both said, John, you don't join a cult knowing that you're joining one. And yes, you actually do have a day on which you leave the group. But because you've left the group doesn't mean that doctrine's left your mind. It will stay there for a shorter, longer period of time. And I think a lot of it depends on how willing the person is to do the work, theologically, mentally, factually. You know, people go to all extremes. People get really angry and they just reject all of Christianity and reject all of the Bible because of what Hobart taught. And that's not a proper response at all. Then there are other people who say, well, I'm going to continue to hold on to everything. And that's not the proper response. Every person has to do the work in their own mind. And I do think that here we are 41 years later. There are a handful of people, well, I won't name any names, that are still probably believing everything he said. At least they're consistent in the sense that they thought he was a messenger of God. And if he's God's messenger, then everything he says was right and you can't leave anything. But they're in the vast minority. I think the people who don't hold to that, but who are not enjoying the podcast at all, are the people who realize that there were some problems. They have distanced themselves from it. You can look at them and see, are they going to a denominational church, quote unquote? That would be a sin in Faith Assembly days. Do they use any medicine? Do they own a TV? Do they wear glasses? Do they associate with other Christians? Do they read a newspaper? Have they ever joined a club? Do the women wear pants? You know, all the lists we've given in the past. they may have backtracked on some of that. And when you look at them, they look, maybe they're more acclimated and attuned to society today. But I think this was a point I wanted to make. I think until you in your mind and with your voice, and I mean with all that is within you, acknowledge Hobart Freeman was a false teacher. He was a false teacher. He had a false ministry. It was false doctrine. Maybe not everything at the beginning, but at the end, everything about it, the whole mindset, the way it was structured, their whole goal, purpose, the way they treated other people, everything about it was wrong and in error. Until a person can stand up on their own two feet and verbally reject, acknowledge that that was what it was, and then reject it, they're not free. So the women who still wear pants and they say, well, I just wear pants because, I mean, don't wear pants. And they say, I just don't wear pants because I think of XYZ, fill it in. That's really not true. The reason they don't is somewhere in them, they still believe what Hobart said about Deuteronomy 22:5. They still believe it's an abomination to God. They don't want to come out and say that forcefully like they did 40 years ago, but they still want to hold on to their beliefs because they still believe that what Dr. Freeman taught was true. And until you can completely mentally, spiritually, biblically rid yourself of it, you're still entangled.
I grew up in a bit of an unusual world. On the father's side, my grandfather was the head pastor at Branham's Tabernacle, the main tabernacle, the big church where Branham preached in Jeffersonville. And on my mother's side, I had what I always referred to, even when I was in the cult, I would refer to them as, they're the normal ones. You had the religious zealot side, and I knew that it was like that even when I was in the cult. And then you had what I called the normal ones. Now, on the normal side, my grandfather, he was still dedicated to William Branham, his teaching, everything that you just said. But he would go to work, he would talk to other Christians who didn't believe like him, who had wives that wore pants and makeup and cut their hair, who had televisions, who did all of the things that the good little cult leader wasn't supposed to do. On the religious zealot side, my grandfather on the father's side would openly condemn people to their face. That's how bad that was. On the other side, I can remember having people who, you know, their wives had short hair or wearing blue jeans. I can remember them in the house at that grandfather's side. While the other side, I remember him actually stopping somebody at the door saying, no, you can't come in. And this is a minister. So my mind was like playing tug of war with this kind of thing, right? Whenever my grandfather approached people who didn't believe like him on the quote unquote normal side, they were as good, friendly people to him as anybody he associated with in the church. He treated people with respect. Until I mention that I'm going to remain a Christian, but I'm no longer part of this message, and that's what we called our group. That was the last time I had any sort of a healthy contact with my grandfather, the normal, quote-unquote normal one. When people are in this martyrdom complex, you see all of the signs of, if it were an actual martyrdom where the whole world is rising up against the martyr, they kind of go into that mindset. And so everything that you've just described, all of the things that you weren't supposed to do in the cult, they're kind of forgiving until the cult leader dies, and then it enters into that martyrdom complex. And it's just, it's fascinating and sad to me. I'm sad because I lost both grandfathers, really, to the cult, if you stop and look at it. But it didn't really have to be that way. And I'm trying to reconcile all of that with just simple, the basics of Christianity. Would you treat other Christians this way? No. Would you even treat an atheist this way? No, you shouldn't. You should treat people with the same respect that you would want them to treat you with. So I see this as fascinating, but like I said, I also see it as sad because there comes a point, especially after the cult leader dies, when people are so dedicated to the martyrdom complex that they lose focus of humanity in general. And they start to, that element that tells them what's right and wrong deep within their soul, it's like it becomes brazen. They really don't care anymore, as long as they can say that they too are martyrs for the cause. And the further this goes, I hate to say it, but the sadder it gets.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
It's a really fine balance, John, that we have to walk in doing these podcasts. I don't think people even understand that, because on the one hand, you have to be factual. You have to deal with the destructive nature of Hobart Freeman and his ministry and church. And when I say the destructive nature, you know, on the one hand, what I'm always reminded of are these letters and emails and texts and messages and meeting people face to face. And I hear these horrific stories of the damage done in people's lives. That's one thing we're dealing with. Then walking the fine line on the other side, these are real people. You know, June was a wife and a pastor's wife and a mother and a grandmother. And the daughters were daughters of Hobart. They were wives. They were mothers. They became grandmothers. These are real human beings. We're not just talking about, bare bone statistics or dates or facts. These are people involved, and it's not easy doing these types of podcasts where you are trying to say what you want to say with both of those things in mind. The facts and the truth need to come out, but at the same time, you feel as a human being for the position that these people were in. But as you just said, if you don't free yourself from it, then you become more and more hardened in it. And then you just treat people so terribly. And I have been treated so terribly by people from Faith Assembly over the years, just because I didn't agree with them. And I had never done any podcast, but back from the very beginning, just because I dared to say, I think that's a misinterpretation of Hebrews 11:13. I don't think you can use that with Hobart dying of multiple illnesses when he said that he wouldn't. I don't think you can use Hebrews 11:13. I just totally get blackballed because of that. So one of the things I've wanted to do in these podcasts is simply and try to do it kindly and graciously, supply the information to the people, some of whom have waited 40 years to have validation, to hear something like what they've heard here, to hear other people who have challenged myself as well as others who've challenged, who've questioned this from years ago, not just recently, from a long time ago. And the people at Faith Assembly, as I said to begin our time today, that propaganda machine began working, and that dishonesty in the leadership soon became reflected in the dishonesty of the rank and file member. And so people really did not know what was going on. So let's go a little further today, John. For after Hobart died in December of 1984, the church kind of limped along for the first few months of 1985. And then bam, yes, bam, another big event happened. So we're going to work our way along and give a few more details chronologically to paint the whole picture, the full picture, and let people put everything together in their own mind. When Hobart was the pastor of the church, they were proud of the fact they had what they called 40 word, quote unquote, ministers. I always laughed when I saw that, because that's just their jargon. The Bible doesn't talk about a group of word ministers. It doesn't use that terminology. And I'm not saying that all your terminology has to come from the Bible or we don't accept it. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying Faith Assembly was so proud of themselves for being a true New Testament church. We are a true church. We preach an uncompromising word. Hobart always said this is a pure message, which means it's nothing of man, it's all of God. Well, they talked about a fivefold ministry: apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, teachers, Ephesians 4:11. And I always accused them, you guys are onefold ministry. All you have are a whole bunch of teachers. You don't have the other four. And they didn't. And they knew they didn't. But because they were a religious cult, they loved using that term, fivefold. We believe in fivefold, and he's a fivefold minister. They just loved saying that because it made them feel good. It made them feel like we believe the Bible. Well, it's one thing to believe the Bible. It's another thing to see the Bible in your life. And you didn't have any apostles or prophets or evangelists or pastors. All you had were teachers. So those word ministers, quote unquote, were the traveling teachers that either taught there at Faith Assembly and or traveled around and had their own satellite meetings. Hobart was the pastor of the church, and he had hand-selected two associate ministers. One of them was Stan Hill, Steve Hill's father. Steve Hill was married to Pam, Hobart and June's oldest daughter. The other minister was Jack Farrell. The reason that Hobart selected those two, and it was wise of him to do that, is they were not the up-and-coming young gang like most of those word ministers, quote-unquote, were. These were two older men, not much younger than Hobart. I mean, born, you know, within 10 years of when Hobart was born in 1920. So he picked them because they were elder men. And as I say, that was a wise decision to have as your two associate pastors, some older men. Both had been ministers in denominational churches before they ever joined Faith Assembly, before they ever heard of Hobart. They had already served in a ministry capacity just in a denominational church. And so there were two of them, as I said. One of them was Stan Hill. The other was Jack Farrell. We're going to talk about both of them today. Stan Hill was Steve Hill's father. None of these ministers, including the associate ministers, were really close to Hobart. Hobart did not have powwow meetings with them. They were simply there to help take the burden off of him when it came to the daily life of the church and the practical concerns. Hobart did not like to deal with people. You can see that in his own personal lifestyle. He wanted to teach at church, get in his car, go back home, stay in his study until it was time to come and teach again. You still have a group of 2,000 or 2,500 people that have needs during the week. And so that would be passed off to Stan Hill and to Jack Farrell. Just a couple of months after Hobart died in December of 1984, Stan Hill had cancer. It was untreated cancer, and he had it badly. He was bedfast at home in a hospital bed. There are newspaper articles that tell the story, so you can get some of your information from the newspaper articles. Steve, Stan's son, one of the main ministers at Faith Assembly. So going back to what I said earlier, Steve is still alive today. And so here's where, in doing these podcasts, you know, we all have to recognize these are real human beings. This was Steve's father-in-law, Hobart, who died. Now this is Steve's father, who has untreated cancer in the worst way. These are human beings, and it's terrible what all these people went through. That's why the podcasts are important. That's why we've done what we've done, because these people died, many of them, most of them, unnecessarily. And that simply has to be called out, or you'll have more people dying. So Steve had asked for different people to come over and pray. And so some of my information about this whole scenario comes from one of those people. So he's an eyewitness. He's an eyewitness. He was there in the house. He was there as Stan Hill died of untreated cancer. He's watched the podcast. He already had inclined away from Freeman, but it took years and years. And that's just, you know, John, it seems to be that's what it takes, unless you can have a documentary, either in a, you know, verbal or a written form, to show people the errors of it. It just takes people a long time to get set free from this. So the person, among other people, you know, who was there, told me the story, and I'm not going to say much about that. Of course, it was a private affair. Stan Hill did not hold the place of Hobart Freeman. He was not the one responsible for all this doctrine, responsible for the death of all of these people. That's why I spent so much time with Hobart himself. You know, you got to give these other guys a break, even though he was an elder man. You know, he had come across Hobart in his ministry and teaching and agreed with it. And, you know, before you know it, you get sucked into it and you're deceived. But in those last days, when the person I know was called over there, Stan Hill's wife, Edna, who was a close friend with June Freeman, maybe we'll show pictures of happier days a few years after this. I was not personal friends with Edna at all, but I did have dinner with her and with June. I knew June a lot better. I did not know Edna at all. I'm just saying that Edna and June were close friends, closer than Hobart and Stan were. Jim Oswalt was over here at the very end also, and Stan just died a very painful death. He was swinging his right arm around so much he could no longer speak that he had to be restrained in his bed. So I just feel sorry to the bottom of my heart for these people that died this way, John, and for Stan's children, Steve among them, who had to witness all this. And I can't read Steve Hill's mind, wouldn't try to, but I feel sorry. I wonder where I would have been had I been in Steve's shoes, where just 3 months before, the leader of the movement, the leader, had died a terrible death, and you witnessed it. You knew everything about it. That's your father-in-law. That's your wife's father. And now, 3 months later, in April of 1985, your own father is dying at the hands of the same false doctrine with untreated cancer. I'm just sorry that it had to happen, and I'm sorry for all of the people involved.
You know, I look back at all of the people who've died of health-related diseases, and I just can't really fathom how it can continue. Even through the psychology, I understand the psychology of, but how can you let it continue? Because that's really the only thing that the cult had. They didn't really have any special doctrine that wasn't that unusual from something else that came from the past. Usually you can go and find what heresy it came from, sadly, but even the parts that our Christian core Christian doctrine, you can go to any denomination, you can find somebody who believes something similar. So they really didn't have anything that was privileged as it relates to doctrine. The only real thing that they had was the divine healing. And then the people died. And they continue to die. I have diabetes. I've actually seen people comment, well, John left the cult. He's got diabetes. Well, so did my dad. So did my grandfather. So did my grandmother, my uncle, my other. I could go right down the line of all the people. Most of, I can't talk about the living ones. There's some HIPAA rules there. But all of the ones who died, you can go straight down the line. They all, right down to William Branham's son, you can find all his health diseases in the documents where his certificate of death. So if you can't really claim anything special to doctrine, and you can't claim anything privileged with regards to healing, what is left? The only thing you have left really is the dead guy. And I don't understand how it can continue. I do understand the psychology of it. I understand the martyrdom complex of and all of that. But the fact that people are still continuing to die and die needlessly, it just tells me that the whole thing needs to stop.
And some people recognize that, John. That leads me into my next story of the other assistant pastor. Hobart was at the top, and he had two under him, Stan Hill and Jack Farrell. And Jack Farrell flat out said, the reason I left is I didn't want to die. You know, he actually wisened up to the fact that if I stay here and continue to accept this doctrine, and I happen to come down with some disease, well, then I can't go to the doctor because that's sin. Then I'm going to end up dying. And Jack actually said, whenever he finally gave an interview to the Warsaw Times Union after he had left, he said, when he gave that interview, I realized I still valued my life. Said I wanted to live. Now, he would, you know, have been just castigated as, oh, you value your life more than God's word. It's because they thought God's word taught Freeman's doctrine, and they were confusing and conflating the two. We should value God's word over our own life, but God's word does not teach what Hobart Freeman taught when it came to no drugs and no doctors and healing in the atonement. And, you know, if it did teach that again, then we're back to square one. Why'd everybody die? You know, you still got to explain all that, which no one can. So Hobart dies in December of 1984. Just a couple of months later, in April of 1985, one of the two associate pastors, Stan Hill, dies of untreated cancer. Now let's only fast forward, John, 2 months to June, early summer 1985. Jack Farrell is now not the pastor, but he is the only remaining of the triumvirate that had been there before. Hobart at the top and Stan and Jack under him. The other two are gone. He's the only one left. And so the second Sunday in June, the day was June the 9th. It was a Sunday morning. Jack was scheduled to preach at the Sunday AM service at the main Faith Assembly building in Wilmot, Indiana. And he strode up to the pulpit and delivered a bombshell. He delivered a bombshell. I did not know Jack at all. I did not know Stan Hill, by the way, at all. So I can contribute nothing personally from my own life or interaction with either one of them. I did not know either one of them at all. But I knew the names, and I knew they were high ranking in the sense that they were not as famous and popular as the young ministers who got all the publicity because they traveled around and, you know, were hot shots. These two guys were older guys who were simply the associates under Hobart. And when he strode up to the pulpit that morning, he knew what he was going to say. Obviously, he did not come to this overnight. This is a newspaper article that actually came out a year after Jack left. The newspapers, I know this, approached him immediately when they found out this had happened, and Jack did not want to give any interviews at that time. You know, he was still processing what was going on, what had happened and what was now happening and what was going to happen. You know, what did his future look like after leaving this place where you have been for a long time? He had, after Hobart died and then after Stan died, he had been talking to people in the church. He was raising questions. He was having to do it extremely carefully because you can't let on as the surviving member of the triumvirate. You can't let on that you have any doubts, suspicions, questions, thoughts contrary to the church and Hobart Freeman doctrine. You can't let on that any of that is in your mind, but in fact it was. And so in that morning when he stood up on June the 9th, Sunday morning, 1985, he told the church, "I'm leaving." And I have to give him a lot of credit for how he handled that. Let me read a little bit from this newspaper article of what Jack had to say, looking back on it a year after this happened. I give Jack a lot of credit, and I don't know the man, did not know the man at all, because it was such a place of fear, and there was so much backbiting. Faith Assembly, you want to talk about a house of gossip and of just evil people who, as soon as someone was caught saying anything that didn't agree with Freeman doctrine, that got reported. Everyone found out about it, and that person got shamed from the pulpit over it. Faith Assembly never practiced any Christian love on a wholesale basis, not at all. They loved to gossip. They loved to take sides. It was always an us against them. It was those of us who were going to remain true to Freeman versus all of those who are going to begin to compromise. But here's a little bit in this newspaper article. The writer says, "Jack's personal involvement with Faith Assembly occurred while he was pastoring a church in Syracuse, Indiana. Seeking a deeper meaning of the Christian faith, he and his wife, Irene, became involved in the charismatic teaching of Freeman at the Glory Barn near North Webster, where the powerful church began. Although he left the Church of the Brethren because of what he viewed as liberal beliefs, he is now extremely thankful for his roots." Quoting Jack, they say, "For many people," Jack said, "who have left Faith Assembly, their only knowledge of the Christian life was learned at Faith Assembly. Therefore, when they leave and see that it's wrong, they don't have anything to fall back on." Farrell recalls the friends he had at Faith Assembly as basically good people who had been misguided by Freeman. "He can relate," he says, "because the theology of Freeman affected him in the same way. When the Farrells first arrived at the Glory Barn in 1974, those experiences with Freeman were meaningful to their personal lives. He recalls those days as both exciting and fulfilling." It's just what I've said before. In the very early times at the Glory Barn in the 1970s, it was a really fun, joyful, loving, happy group of people. And Hobart just took them down a really dangerous road. And so when Jack stood up on the morning of June the 9th, 1985, there are really two things that he had to say. I mean, he said what he had to say, but I give him so much credit for handling it publicly rather than just sneaking out the back door, which probably many of us would have been tempted to do, writing a letter to Steve or to June or somebody and then sneaking out the back door or just not showing up anymore. I have to give him a lot of credit because he just stood up there and said, you know, "Here are my beliefs. Two in particular," he said, "number one, I think we're full of pride. I think this whole church is a church based on pride and arrogance and presuming on God, on scripture, on everyone around us, on everything. We are a people filled with pride." That was the main thing Jack stressed. And I think he was right. And I think he had been taught that attitude by Hobart Freeman. Hobart was extremely arrogant, boasting about himself all the time, putting everyone else down. He's the only one that God, according to him, had entrusted the full end time message of faith to. You know, that just engenders pride. And all of us, myself included, who were under Freeman's ministry and the sound of his voice, you know, you can't help but pick up the same thing. I think I've said before, because I knew, according to Hobart, healing's in the atonement. And one of the things God is healing is people of their bad vision. Then if I ever saw anybody wearing glasses, I couldn't help but look on them critically. And what do I mean by that? Well, you look on them wondering, why don't you have faith for God to heal you? Because it was entrenched in you that, oh, God's healing people's eyes. And you know what? I don't know of any eyes God was healing. Everybody who took off their glasses and waited for God to heal their eyes never got healed. And either A, they just had someone chauffeur them the rest of their life, or B, they drove illegally, or three, they finally put on their glasses. Not very many people, John, can see well without glasses past what age? I don't know. I'm not an optometrist or an ophthalmologist. I don't know what the cutoff is. But Hobart always joked about, well, now Moses, his eye was not dim, Deuteronomy 34, when he was 120 years of age. And if God will do it for Moses, God would do it for us. And he would mock people who would say, well, you know, brother, as you get older, your eyes just kind of get set. And he would always say, now, if everything gets too set, that means you're dead. It was always something funny, but something critical said about eyes and about people wearing glasses. Hobart's vision began to fail. He went to a giant print Bible. Then he couldn't pass his driver's test, according to what I have been told. And June had to drive him to and from church. And so looking back on how people suffered by not being allowed to wear glasses, or if you wear them, you have to wear them in shame, is simply a terrible thing. My driver's license just last month, my birth month is January, and here in the state of Kentucky, in order to renew your license, they have a new law. And guess what? You have to go and see an eye doctor, and you have to have vision screening. And I don't wear glasses, but I don't think I see. I'm looking out my door now. I don't think I see terribly great. I don't have the eyes of an eagle, that's for sure. And you got to be able to see far away, and you have to be able to see close up. But I went to the eye doctor, no way to get my driver's license renewed. And I was shocked with the happy news that the eye doctor said. So, well, you legally can see fine. You don't have to wear glasses to drive. You don't have perfect vision, but you can legally drive. That's not going to be the case for most people. You're going to need some help here. And so I was just very proud of Jack being able to recognize this business of no medicine, no doctors. He said, I want to live, and I don't want to live in pride anymore. And the second thing that Jack said when he stood up to preach, he said, only 6 months after Hobart's death, that I think that we all are in bondage to a man. And what he charged him with is the exact thing that I had said from back in the 1980s. Hobart loved to talk against two particular religious delusions, let's say, probably because they both arose in charismatic circles. One was the JDS heresy, the Jesus died spiritually heresy. He loved to preach against that and just talk about it, these JDS heretics. The other one that he actually talked about before JDS had even come on the scene was shepherdship. And the shepherdship, Fort Lauderdale 4, neo-discipleship, covering, submission to a man, bondage people. He actually did a 3-tape series, and then he did an updating, and you had to buy them all to get any. And he was addressing the shepherdship error of the early 1970s. And guess where the biggest shepherdship group in the whole world was? Faith Assembly. I mean, those people had to follow every single thing Hobart said in order to be in good graces. So thankfully, Jack recognized the pride. Jack recognized, he said, I charge Faith Assembly with being in shepherdship bondage. He was 100% right. He said those two things when he finished saying what he had to say. He walked right past a friend of mine who was sitting right on the end. My friend said, I'll never forget. I'm hearing Jack say this. You know, this church is stunned. I'm hearing Jack say this. He closed his Bible. He walked right past me. I mean, he didn't stay to sign autographs or have a meet and greet afterwards. He walked right past my friend, right down the aisle, right out the front door, and ended up working in a donut shop. And so here's where I'm going to leave us today. I want people to kind of have these ideas and thoughts in their mind, and we'll pick up with this next time. In October of 1984, second in command, the only person underneath Freeman, but this much underneath him, was Bruce Kinsey. He up and quit. October of 84. December of 84, the pastor, the leader, Hobart Freeman, dies. He doesn't quit, but he died. He quits involuntarily because he dies. In April, Stan Hill, one of the assistant pastors, dies. In June of 1985, just like Bruce, we have Jack Farrell quitting. So now you have lost the four top members as far as leadership is concerned at Faith Assembly. Two voluntarily, two involuntarily, but you have these men simply gone. And I cannot imagine what was going on in the minds of the rank and file members of Faith Assembly.
I can't imagine what's going through the minds of the people either, but you're talking about the glasses. We never had it as bad as you. We did not have people, well, we did have some people dying, but for the most part, we didn't have people dying over abandoning the use of medicine. However, we had people that tried as best they could. And I remember I had a family member who said they went to get their driver's license and they had to squint like everything to try to pass that thing without their glasses. Now, we didn't have the same level of glasses doctrine you had, but we had the underlying intent. We had basically the early version of what you had. And I remember him telling me this. And at the time, I didn't know that what we had wasn't usual, typical Christianity. I just thought that this is the Christian way to be like this. But even that didn't make sense to me because I'm like, why would I want you to ever drive without glasses on? This is not only is this dangerous for you, this is, you basically have turned a vehicle into a missile and you can do some real damage with that thing. Now, please wear your glasses. So we didn't have it as bad as you, but it's, like I said, it's all part of this complex that you get when the cult leader dies. You try to prove the thing that was wrong, clearly wrong. You try to prove it to be correct so that you can justify and make some sense of your life. And that's really the bottom line for me is Hobart Freeman robbed so many people of their normal lives, of their normal happiness. And the people who are left holding the bag after he died, they're just simply trying to make sense of what happened. And because you can't make sense of it, the things that you do to uplift the dead cult leader become nonsensical. So thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.